Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Whistleblowers in the Air Force went to Military Times, to a reporter there that they trusted, and blew this story on the 5th of September. If they hadn't done this, we wouldn't even know that this had happened.
Journalist, author, and two-time Fulbright scholar David Lindorf joins us for the half hour to discuss his latest stories on leaving the Democratic Party, Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, impeachment of the president and vice president, and a disturbing incident August 30th involving nuclear-tipped cruise missiles flown in launch position on a B-52 from a base in Minot, North Dakota, to one in Barksdale, Louisiana. The Bush administration has called this a mistake, but Barksdale is a staging area for B-52s sent to the Middle East for combat duty, writes Lindorf in DailyCoast.com. You can learn more on his website, www.thiscan'tbehappening.net. He's written for The Nation and other publications on U.S. war signals against Iran. You can find his work at counterpunch.org. David Lindorf, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Dori.
You have written that you believe the loading of these warheads on the B-52 was not accidental. Just describe this case of armed nukes aboard B-52s.
I certainly have grave doubts about whether it's a mistake. What happened is, and a lot of people would be excused for not knowing this because it got such short shrift in the media. I think CNN ran something. There was a short little notice in the Times, and then there was a big piece in the Washington Post, which basically follows the Pentagon line on this, that it was a mistake. But most local papers ignored the story completely, even though it involved the flying of six cruise missiles armed with 150 kiloton warheads from North Dakota down to Louisiana, the first time, first of all, that bombs have been allowed in a bomber or even gotten attached to a bomber in 40 years because it's been barred over the domestic U.S. And secondly, the first time in the history of nuclear weapons that six weapons went unaccounted for and unguarded for 36 hours or even 1 hour. So you would think this would be a huge story. And I suspect that had it happened in Russia, it would be all over the front pages of the U.S. and we'd be having hearings in Congress, you know, every day. But because it happened in the U.S. and the Pentagon says, oh, it was all a mistake, it just died. But what we know happened is that 12 of these cruise missiles were loaded onto the wing launch pods of a B-52 Stratofortress in Minot, North Dakota, at a strategic base, six of them with nuclear weapons, and were then flown to Louisiana. The pilots supposedly didn't know they had the missiles with weapons on the plane, just empty missiles, and they parked the plane on a remote area of the tarmac where it sat unguarded and unnoticed basically for 10 hours until ground crews from Barksdale went out to the plane and instantly spotted the warheads, and, you know, then all hell broke loose, although no notice was given to the press.
These are a lot bigger than what the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Each warhead is 10 times as large as the bomb dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. The missiles themselves are only fitted with nuclear warheads. They're not like Tomahawk missiles, which have an optional conventional head or a warhead. These are large missiles that were designed to allow the B-52s, which are 45 years old, to be continued in use as strategic weapons because they could be fired from 1,000 miles off the coast of a country like Russia and fly to their targets following the contours of the ground and leave the stratofortresses to fly home. Now they're obsolete, and there's 400 of them that are slated for demolition. So supposedly this was a run to take 12 of them down to Barksdale for destruction, but somehow the people at Minot managed to load six bombs onto these despite all the supposed safeguards we have to prevent nuclear weapons from getting out of their bunkers. Now, two things I find troubling. First of all, the government and the Washington Post, which used government sources to say it was all a mistake, are basically suggesting that there was a inadvertent error where some guys mounted the six warheads onto six of the missiles, and then somebody else, not noticing that they were armed, took them out with the other six, demolition run, you know, taking them down to Barksdale. The problem with this is whoever put the six onto that pod had to know they were nukes, because my daughter's a mathematician, and I said, if you have 12 pod spots and you have six dummy nukes and six nukes, what are the chances that you would inadvertently put six nukes all on one pod and six dummies on the other? And she told me it's one in 924. So I think we can rule out that this happened by accident. Somebody knew, first of all, that they'd loaded nukes on the pod. The second thing that I have a problem with is that they claim that somebody moved that pod out and mounted it onto the Stratofortress wing, not knowing that it was a nuke, because everybody knows that since 1991, there was an executive order that you're not even allowed to, for training purposes, load a nuclear weapon onto a stationary bomber and then take it off again. So whoever put these weapons on would have had to not know they were nuclear armed. The problem with that is that when the weapons got to Barksdale, which had no reason to expect nuclear weapons mounted on that plane, the ground crew immediately spotted them as nukes, immediately, as soon as they got to the plane. So if those guys could see right away that they were dealing with nuclear warheads, how the hell could the people at Minot, who deal with nuclear weapons all the time, have not known they were mounting them?
How would these things normally be airlifted if they're going to be?
Well, you never ship nuclear weapons mounted on the missiles. You ship the missiles separately, and the bombs themselves are not to be carried on a bomber, period. So any nuclear weapon that's slated for dismantling, which these are under the SALT Accord, they have to be shipped to the Pantex plant that does all the disassembly in Amarillo, Texas, by special air transport. They have these planes that are specially fitted with containers that can survive a crash if the plane goes down without releasing any nuclear materials. You would never put it on a Stratofortress because the whole plane could crash and you'd spill nuclear materials all over the countryside. So this was a totally illegal operation, and my first concern is that there's no way that this could have been done accidentally. And then there are six mysterious deaths involving the bases that this happened at in the weeks immediately preceding and following the incident, and also one on the day of the flight. So you had a husband and wife at Barksdale who died in a motorcycle accident in Shreveport right near the Barksdale base on, I believe, July 20th, 5 weeks before. You had a death of a B-52 pilot from Minot on a motorcycle July 5th in his home state of Tennessee, a lone motorcycle accident. You had a death of another pilot, B-52 pilot from Minot, on September 15th, 2 weeks after the incident, in a one-car car crash where the car ran off the road and hit a tree and burned. The driver is in critical condition, and the passenger was the bomber pilot. And then a suicide on September 7th by a young guy who was in the unit that guards the weapons at Minot. He allegedly shot himself in the head at his home in Virginia. And lastly, and this one I find truly mysterious, a B-52 crew member from not either of those bases, but from Hurlburt Air Force Base, which when I checked, the website turns out to advertise itself as the headquarters for something I didn't even know existed. It's called the Air Force Special Operations Command. I had no idea that the Air Force had its own special operations, but then you wonder, why would a B-52 crew member be in special operations? B-52s are strategic bombers. They don't drop people out of parachutes. They just drop bombs. So special operations, then when you go to their website, their motto is, while Americans are sleeping in their security blanket of freedom, we work in the dark places, making sure that that security blanket stays safe. That's pretty scary stuff. So this guy committed suicide on August 30th, and his alleged suicide is very weird. He had flown to Portland, Oregon, allegedly to go to a wedding of his best friend, but he never showed up at the wedding. This is a guy who has a lovely wife, two beautiful children and had just gotten word that he was being promoted from captain to major. So you would think this was a guy without too many troubles, although, you know, who knows what his personal life was like. In any case, he calls on the 29th from a roadside rest area on the interstate just outside Portland, saying that he's going for a hike in a nearby park. And then a day later, he calls again from the airport. And on that first day, he didn't have a car, which makes the call from the rest area kind of strange. The next day, he rents a car at the airport in Portland to his family, and then he's not ever heard from again. His family did a missing persons request with the Portland police. They put out a search, and 10 days later, his car was found 120 miles away in the state of Washington near Mount St. Helens. They call in dogs and search and find the body in the woods and call it a suicide. But the strange thing is he had a knapsack containing a global positioning device and a video cam, which are both very strange things for someone who's planning on killing himself.
Let's say this was a covert operation, only a few people knew about it. And let's also say that it's possible that a lot of the crew at Barksdale or even the airport where these things originated didn't know what was happening. That would explain the 10-hour delay in anyone addressing the weapons or just letting them sit there. I mean, if they had been discovered, then anyone who was trying to perpetrate a covert operation or a sneak plan, let's say an illegal theft of these weapons, wouldn't approach them. Also, if they were headed for the Middle East, where would you think they might be headed? Let me just ask those two questions. You can take your guess at what might have happened.
The warheads on these missiles are kind of unusual in that they can be calibrated so that they can explode with a force of 150 kilotons or with as small an explosion as 5 kilotons, which makes them from strategic weapons into what the Pentagon likes to call tactical nuclear weapons for, you know, isolated use, not to do so much damage. That raises a number of possibilities. They're not suitable for penetrating underground, these missiles. So they wouldn't be particularly effective, although at 150 kilotons, you don't need to dig a hole before you explode it. So they're not the ideal weapon for taking out Iran's nuclear facilities, most of which are deeply buried underground. But they could be useful as a false flag kind of operation if you calibrated it down to 5 kilotons and had it hit a small ship, say a U.S. destroyer. It might look like a Iranian weapon because it would be very weak. And, of course, all the evidence would be destroyed in the explosion. So one line of thinking is that this was going to be a false flag operation. A lot of people think we may have our sort of Gulf of Tonkin excuse for starting a nuclear war with Iran. Another scenario would have it just that these were for use against Iran. The problem I have with that is that there are nuclear weapons on the aircraft carriers in the Gulf. If it was an above-board, if you will, plan to use nukes against Iran by the military, they wouldn't need to go to some subterfuge to get 6 nukes over there. They've got them. But if it's a side campaign, like you're suggesting, you know, with perhaps from Cheney's office using an alternate chain of command to do something that the military doesn't know about, maybe there was an intent to get the weapons over there and then use one and not say who used it and just drop something on Iran and get things going. Newsweek reported that Cheney had tried to convince Israel to launch an attack on Iran so that Iran would retaliate and the U.S. would get dragged into the war with Iran. That's an astonishing thing all by itself, that a vice president would be trying to manipulate foreign policy on such a grand scale himself when the State Department and the Defense Department obviously don't want that. I mean, I think that's an act of treason, but it wasn't presented that way in Newsweek. We obviously have a vice president who's a loose cannon, and anything is possible. And then Wayne Madsen, a reporter who has done some pretty good work, I wouldn't call him Cy Hirsch, but he claims with all unidentified sources in the military that this actually was a Cheney operation and that the Air Force and the Defense Department got wind of it and stopped it, and then is presenting it as a mistake, but it's another scenario.
Doesn't Dick Cheney have authority over America's nuclear arsenal at this point?
There are rumors that he does, but the chain of command does not give him any role in the military chain of command, commander-in-chief, anything. He only has authority if the president is incapacitated.
Well, we are talking in many cases about the very same people who perpetrated Iran-Contra, right?
Oh, definitely. We have some of the very same people who committed that criminal enterprise of a separate chain of command with secret diplomacy and secret weapons shipments and secret fighting against the Nicaraguan government. People like Michael Ledeen and Elliot Abrams and that neocon crew are working now with Cheney, and they had been working with Rumsfeld and that whole gang within the Pentagon. So there is the possibility of an alternate chain of command that could do something like this. We also know that the Air Force is infested with these fundamentalist, Armageddon-believing religious nuts from top to bottom. So it's possible that in league with neocon people, there is a group that would do this kind of thing and go outside of the lines of authority. I find what's really intriguing and maybe a cause for optimism is that we found out about this because three whistleblowers in the Air Force went to Military Times to a reporter there that they trusted and blew this story on the 5th of September. If they hadn't done this, we wouldn't even know that this had happened. What it suggests to me, and I got confirmation from this from several military experts, including retired Colonel Sam Gardner, it's very rare to have military people go outside of their ranks to the press as whistleblowers. That's extremely rare. And he says the fact that it's happening is a sign that the rank-and-file military have lost confidence in their senior commanders being anything but political sycophants and hacks for the White House, and so they are doing the right thing. I think, hopefully, that we can count on a lot of the people in the military taking their oaths of office to uphold and defend the Constitution seriously.
Quoting you here, the U.S. Senate, by an outrageous vote of 76-22, just passed the Kyle Lieberman Amendment. This means that the Senate, including half the Democrats in that body, have endorsed war with Iran. What do you mean they're endorsed war?
Lieberman's amendment was very consciously designed to help get the U.S. into a war with Iran. And I say that as a Connecticut native and someone who finds Lieberman to be a reprehensible character from day one. This guy slipped in this amendment to the defense spending bill, which initially actually called on the president to use military force against Iran. That would have been a flat-out declaration of war authorization for the president. But the Democrats took out the paragraph justifying military operations against Iran, but they left in Lieberman's second stroke, which was to declare the Revolutionary Guards in Iran a global terrorist organization. Now, the reason this is tantamount to a declaration of war is that Bush has claimed consistently since September 18th of 2001 that the authorization for use of military force that passed that day and authorized the attack on Afghanistan was also an authorization of the global war on terror, and I would put war in quotes there, that he claims he is fighting and that makes him commander-in-chief of the entire world. Because he claims the global war on terror has no boundaries. The battleground is the U.S., it's the rest of the world. He feels he has been authorized since 2001 to attack any country or any organization that is a terrorist organization or supports terror. Once the Senate declares the Revolutionary Guard to be a global terrorist organization, Bush can say, oh, well, I have the authority already to attack them.
Turning now to some of the pieces on your website, thiscan'tbehappening.net, you have called on Democrats to abandon the party as a way to bring pressure. I see here an I Quit the Party page. Just comment on that and also on the potential for using some of the ongoing challenges to Bush policy. There is Henry Waxman, California Democrat. He's holding hearings about Blackwater as chair of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Blackwater led, of course, by Eric Prince, who's being questioned about his employees shooting Iraqis. Prince, of course, one of those religious types you may have been referring to. He's been linked to Dobson and Focus on the Family, which is in turn linked to the U.S. Air Force Academy. Is it possible that Democrats could work through someone like Waxman? I mean, just keep pushing his committee and working through that investigation and others like it to bring needed change?
Technically, they could. I mean, Waxman could do it all by himself because he's one of the few people in Congress who has the authority to issue subpoenas without even getting committee approval. He can do it on his own authority. But I think that it has become clear that the leadership of the Democratic Party has no intention of doing anything to seriously resist the Bush administration. It's not that they don't have the courage to do it. It's that they've made a strategic decision that they're going to win in 2008 by letting this Republican Party damage itself, and they're not going to step in to stop the war. They're not going to step in to defend the Constitution in any serious way. They are trying to keep their heads down, do the minimum, pass legislation that they know can't take effect because of vetoes and signing statements, but that they can point to and say, we tried. And then, you know, ride into November of 2008 and say, we could do better if you give us more of a majority and a Democratic president. It's a disastrous plan. It's premised on the idea that they can count on progressives to vote for them no matter how they screw us, and that they can appeal to this mythical middle-of-the-roader, unaffiliated voter and win the way they won in 2006. The problem with this whole plan is that the middle-of-the-road voter doesn't really exist. Most of the unaffiliated voters I've found, and studies are showing, are very passionate but cynical about politics. And they think they're being screwed by both parties, by the corporations, they're anti-NAFTA. They came over to the Democrats in 2006 because they believed that the Democrats would stop the war and also that they would defend the Constitution. And they're not going to come back the next time. So my argument is that progressives, after having been taken for granted and stepped on for the last 40-odd years since the New Deal went down, need to really shake up the Democratic leadership and say, we're not yours anymore. You can't count on us. And my argument is the way to do that is a mass campaign to have progressives quit the party. Go to your registrar or voters, delist. I urge people to do it en masse, you know, as public protest. 100 people at a time march down to the registrar and deregister so it makes it into the media. I think that's the only way we're going to really wake up the leadership, that they're going to have to do what we want if they want to have a chance in 2008.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has become well known for his biting social commentaries. He's been seeking a new trial after serving 25 years on death row. He's gotten various reprieves, but in your book, Killing Justice, your investigation into the case includes documentation on what a specific judge did. That was Judge Szabo 25 years ago. Just comment on what you learned and how it applies today.
Well, the case was heard by a 3-judge appellate panel, and we're just waiting to hear what they decide. If 2 of those 3 judges decide any of the 3 avenues for appeal that were presented are valid, then what's likely to happen, it's not likely to resolve the issue, but they're likely to send the case back to a lower federal district court for a reconsideration of these issues. So there's several things that could happen. If the court accepts the quite sound argument that was made that the jury was improperly stripped of qualified blacks who were willing to vote for a death penalty but were just taken off because they were black, leaving him with 2 black jurors in a city that was 44% black at the time, he would get a new trial. But the process would be first to go back for a full hearing on that issue before a federal district judge. So that's one avenue. Another would be if the determination were made that he did not get a fair, what's called a PCRA hearing, post-conviction, that hearing that every death penalty convict is entitled to examine the evidence that was used in this trial and see if it was fair. That hearing was overseen by the same judge who had tried the case, and not surprisingly, that judge found that everything he had decided at the trial was correct. And that kind of set the stage for killing his appeal, because under laws passed by Clinton, the Effective Death Penalty Act, one of the travesties of the Clinton administration, any decision on fact-finding by a state court has to be accepted as unquestioned by any federal court considering the appeal. So Szabo's role in determining that everything that was presented at the trial was correct was devastating to this case. The thing about Szabo, and this would come up if the appeals court decides that there was an issue there, is that Szabo was overheard by another judge, a colleague, saying as he left the first day of Jamal's trial, "Yeah, and I'm going to help them fry that nigger." Now, no judge who says that should sit on a trial and hear a case. No judge who says that should even be a judge. But even though there's good evidence that two people overheard that, one of whom's gone public with it and one of whom told me, the courts in Pennsylvania right up to the Supreme Court have held that it doesn't matter. A judge actually said when they brought that case to her, you know, it doesn't matter what a judge's personal opinions are because the trial's decided by a jury. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard, but it was actually said. So this case is just rife with racism and lying and malpractice by the prosecution and by the judges from the bottom to the appellate level in the state of Pennsylvania. So clearly there should be a new trial, but whether he'll get it, I don't know. I mean, the judges at the federal level, too, have not been particularly fair about his appeal.
What's your level of hope about some of the ongoing efforts to restore the Constitution and restore the rights of citizens as well as American democracy?
Right now, I'm pretty pessimistic. I think that the so-called efforts to restore constitutional government that we see going on in Congress are a sham because the margins that Democrats control the two houses by are razor thin, especially in the Senate, and thanks in part to your Senator Lieberman. And even if they could pass legislation to undo some of the abuses of power that have developed from the Republicans running Congress and allowing Bush to do whatever he wants, they can't survive a veto by the president. They don't have the two-thirds to override a veto. But even if they managed to do that with liberal Republican support or libertarian Republican support, then you have the problem that the president has claimed the right to use his power as commander-in-chief during what he calls a time of war, meaning his war on terror, to simply not enact laws passed by the Congress. He's done this over 1,000 times now. This is what the signing statements thing is about. It's not really the signing statements that are the issue. It's the claim he's commander-in-chief and he doesn't have to obey the Constitution. And as long as he asserts that power, nothing Congress does has any weight at all. So really the only way to take back the Constitution, to take back the rights that have been lost and to undo the abuses of power is impeachment. Now, you could argue, as Democrats do, well, we'll fix this when we get in power after 2008. That, first of all, assumes that they will come to power in 2008, which I have grave doubts about, given their stupid policy. But second, very rarely in the history of mankind have people given up power that they have. Now, if Hillary Clinton or Obama or Edwards were to come to power in 2008 and then be looking at these powers that Bush has bequeathed on them, I don't see them giving those up. I see them using them and saying, oh, it's a great thing. I don't have to enact a law passed by Congress. I can take over the National Guard if I want. I can use the military for police actions in the United States if I want. You know, I can spy on my enemies if I want with the NSA. Why would they give that up? I don't think they will.
David Lindorf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Longtime investigative reporter David Lindorf. His 2006 book with Barbara Olshansky is The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. His 2003 book was Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. David Lindorf's website is www.thiscan'tbehappening.org. You can find his work at counterpunch.org and other publications, and learn more about the stories we've been discussing at rawstory.org or afterdowningstreet.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. This program was produced at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut.